Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 306 of the podcast. And it is 28th of January 2017 as I record this. So today I'm thrilled to have another interview with Stephen Pressfield, which is amazing because he's such a mentor to me and I know many of you through his books, The War of Art, Turning Pro, and all his other books. He has so many. Today we're talking about The Knowledge, which is his new book, a fictionalized version of his own creative origin story. And interestingly, we talk a little about writing in many genres, and he says that that's probably a mistake. And it's a lot smarter commercially to find an identity and stick with that. But his muse leads him in a lot of different directions. And I'm sure many of you listening can identify with that. So we also talk about theme, deciding on book titles, and why blogging is great for writers, because Steve still blogs every week. So if you're a writer who says, oh, blogging is just not worth it, then, you know, I always think, well, if Stephen Pressfield blogs, I mean, come on. So I hope you'll enjoy that interview, which is coming up. First of all, in publishing news this week, South Africa's Exclusive Books customers move to Canada's Kobo. So another move for Kobo, which is basically kind of sucking up and taking into itself all of these smaller ebook vendors around the world. And I really like that because it's, you know, instead of creating one sort of monolithic approach, Kobo is sort of working with other smaller companies and bringing together, into a more powerful company. And yeah, anyway, I just thought it was really interesting. And we get one of these every couple of weeks, really. There's a new, and each of these are small, obviously, but together they add up to a pretty big global footprint. So as ever, you know, I'm a Kobo fan. And also, if you want an in-depth discussion of all the news out of digital book world, so last week I did quite an extensive introduction on some of the publishing stuff, but I have a whole hour on discussing those publishing topics with Orna Ross. We have a new monthly self-publishing salon, we're calling it, because it's basically me and Orna, who's the founder of the Alliance of Independent Authors and a friend of mine and creatively amazing. And we discuss publishing news once a month, basically anything that interests us. And this month we talk all about the news out of digital book world, about the figures on print. We talk about all kinds of things. So you can check that out at thecreativepen.com/salon, S-A-L-O-N, and that will redirect you to the links for the salon. And really enjoyed that chat. Orna and I just, you know, geeking out over publishing news. On futurist stuff, I got a really interesting article from singularityhub.com about India building the infrastructure for a truly digital economy. Fascinating post about India leapfrogging ahead of the West, as in beyond Bitcoin. It has built a digital infrastructure that will soon process billions more transactions than Bitcoin ever has. With this, India will skip two generations of financial technologies, which is kind of crazy. And I think it's really interesting for us because, I've talked before about how the internet is streaming internet is being rolled out to the rest of the world by 2020. That's the plan. So 5 billion more people on the internet. But one of the issues with that is many of the people in these other countries don't have bank accounts, don't have necessarily a physical address. There's no credit cards. And we're so used to cards and doing online payments with cards by typing in numbers, we don't even question the process behind that. But they basically are creating a different way of transacting. And what it will mean is that, let's say by 2020 or 2025 or whatever, it will mean that people in these other countries have streaming internet, but they can also do online purchases for things like ebooks. Now, clearly this has a much bigger impact than just people can buy our books, but it's one of the things, this expansion of digital technology. And obviously, as ever, there are pros and cons with a cashless society, but it's a fascinating read if you're into looking ahead and the futurist stuff. So I'll put that link in the show notes as ever. So my personal update, I have given the sweet romance a rest this week because I needed to go dark, and I've returned to researching and thinking about my map books. And I'm always influenced where I live by where I live. The London Psychic books were written after we moved back to the UK. Risen Gods, obviously about New Zealand, where I lived for 7 years. And the arcane thrillers are kind of set all over the world where I've traveled. And so the map books open in Bath, and I've been trying to look at Bath with a kind of a new eye. And so it was really interesting to do this research. I'm also QA listening to the new recordings, pro narrator recordings of The Successful Author Mindset and How to Make a Living with Your Writing. They will be up on ACX and then Audible in February. And actually, it was really great because I was listening to the mindset book, and it's really good for me to listen to my own self telling me something, because I'm going through this self-doubt at the moment about the map books. Like, creating a new series is, it's really quite hardcore. And I feel, you know, some days I just feel like, oh my goodness, this is really hard. I'd forgotten how hard this is. And then, you know, then it's fun and you go through these cycles of emotion. So listening to The Successful Author Mindset is making me feel a lot better. And it's funny because I'm thinking, well, I wrote this. Why didn't I remember this like last week when I was feeling down or whatever? So it's quite meta in one way, but very good in another way. And, on the commercial side of things, as I mentioned last week, because of the potential of audio developments in 2017, I will be going non-exclusive to ACX. So I will be taking the smaller royalty and keeping the ability to distribute in, and I'll be selling direct and also putting the books out through other channels when they become available. And those of you who bought my own recordings of these books will get those new files updated. So or you might want to keep my original, slightly more amateur recordings, which will now be rare because I'm so enamored of using a pro narrator that I will be getting my other nonfiction books done this year. Although I've got the How to Market a Book next to me. And I'm looking at revamping that for this year. And it'd be interesting how much has changed. I mean, a lot has changed, but fundamental principles are still the same. Okay, so talking of self-doubt, I also wanted to mention the new Petal to the Metal podcast with Jay Thorne and Rachel Herron. Great show name, Petal to the Metal. Lovely. Rachel is the petal and Jay Thorne is the metal, which is cool. And they discuss the journey of leaving the day job for full-time writing, a shift Jay is making in the next few months and Rachel did last year. And they talk about fear, insecurity, imposter syndrome, and much more. So if you're someone who's thinking about this, or you're on the edge, or you're just going through this now, check it out at thepetaltothemetal.com, or you can Google Petal to the Metal podcast. All the links will be in the show notes. And I had a listen to Jay and Rachel. They're quite charming. They really are. It's a good show. I would say it's possibly not safe for work, but there you go. I've also been prepping the launch of End of Days, which is out this week on the 31st of January. The print book is out already, but the ebook will launch 31st of January. And it's so funny as I'm writing, you know, starting to think about the map book and having this sort of self-doubt about my ability to ever write a novel again. And then, of course, End of Days, which I've got the print book here on my desk because I'm in love with the cover. and the feedback I'm getting from my pen friends, who are my sort of first reader group, are saying that it's a great book and they love it. But of course, we always feel self-doubt about our work. And I'm excited about the launch, but also a little bit kind of, but yeah, I'm really in love with the cover anyway. So check out the cover, even if you're not interested in the book. so this week, we're off to New Zealand and I'm concentrating on the wonderful thought of being in the sun and by the beach and having a swim in the sea rather than the 28 hours in a plane, which is the hideous part of going to the opposite side of the world. Although, again, we're so lucky that we can just do that. I'll be speaking in Auckland and doing some consulting and also speaking in Brisbane in a couple of weeks' time, which is very cool. I'm really looking forward to meeting members of the Creative Pen community down under. And next week, I will be actually recording this introduction from Auckland. I now have a on-the-go process that the lovely Dan has helped me with. Dan, who does the audio for the show now. So yes, I'll be talking about that next week. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets. Here is a selection. Jane says, I'm miles away from you, but I listen to your podcast while beating the traffic in Manila in the Philippines. I used to skip the intros of your podcasts until I realized that that's where I can hear all the updates. I'm happy to hear you were an IT person before, so am I, although mine's still in the present tense. Thanks, Jane, and great to hear you've converted to listening to the intro. Harley Christensen said, thanks for letting me know about the Write Life promoting business for authors, and also for the lovely picture of her walking partner, Max, who's a gorgeous dog. Madeline D'Este, perhaps, says, as another recovering good girl, the show with Christine Rush was an inspiring lesson. Thank you, Madeline. Cheryl says, just bought End of Days. I'm excited. Is it okay to read the Arcane novels out of order? Yes, it is. Thank you for asking, Cheryl. Yes, all of my books are designed to be read standalones as well as in a series. So yeah, like most series books. I mean, when we're writing series books, there's that moment where you have to kind of repeat the same information in case somebody has just joined the series. So I, for example, explaining Arcane, which is an acronym, you know, what does that stand for? And a little bit about Arcane, you know, like the three sentences that mean you can start the books anytime and you still get it. At Script Medic says, listening to the show on the long, dark, rainy drive home after working on the ambulance all day. Great show. Ellen Bard had a Thai massage today while listening to the podcast. Who says you can't relax? And sent a picture of her getting massaged, which is awesome. Hi, Ellen. And finally, Joshua Kihi or Kehe. Says, the podcast is the best thing about Monday mornings. Always helps me start my week on the right foot. I'm thrilled you like it, Joshua. Thank you so much. Okay, so today's episode is sponsored by my own How to Write a Novel course. I thought that would be appropriate because as I was creating the course, I was also writing End of Days. So the course actually, you know, is the process of writing that novel and includes a behind the scenes look at, you know, the research, the writing, the editing, the whole thing. And the course is for people who might have started writing but are stuck and frustrated with the process, those overwhelmed by too much information and just want a simple path to follow, and those who have a novel already but perhaps it just doesn't work or it's not selling and you want to revisit the basics. And the course is video and audio, which you can watch or listen to on any device, and also includes a private members-only Facebook group, which, you know, I do get on Facebook to talk to people in the group. Okay, one course member, Lee Anderson, said, this course is exactly what I was looking for. I now feel well on my way to writing and completing my first draft. It has been a real breakthrough for me. And you can check it out at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. And clearly I know how to write a novel, so I will get over my self-doubt and get on with my next books. Okay, so this kind of sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Sustainable Living Podcast, Redital Group, Lizzie Mays, Aninka Limasson, Michelle Leedy and Ruth Wetherill. Thank you so much to everybody and everyone who's been supporting the show for so long. I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like your tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And of course, you get the extra Q&A show if you are a Patreon supporter. So an extra 30 to 40 minutes of me answering your questions every month. And that will be recorded from New Zealand this month. So you can support the show with even just the price of a coffee a month, and you'll get that extra audio. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and I'm here today with Stephen Pressfield. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Joanna. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. It's great.
It is. Thank you so much. Just a little introduction. Steve is the author of novels around the classical wars of ancient Greece and modern warfare, like Gates of Fire, non-fiction works, including The War of Art and Turning Pro, and screenplays, including The Legend of Bagger Vance. His latest book is The Knowledge, which I have here, close to be true novel. So, Steve, I want to start by asking you, like, you write across so many genres, as we've heard. You have so many ideas. Why The Knowledge and why now?
That's a great question. But, Joanna, I'm a believer, Joanna, as you know, in the muse leading us, you know? I feel it's sort of like a kite surfer, where you're the surfer down on the water, and this kite is pulling you along. So that this idea just sort of came to me, but it is something I've wanted to do for a long time. I mean, it's obviously personal. It's a lot of it's true. Mm. And it's the setting and the events, or at least the interior events of the knowledge, are sort of my quote unquote all is lost moment from back in the 70s in New York when I was driving a taxi cab. And I had always kind of wanted to do this, but I never could find the spin or the twist that would make it work. And I sort of had an idea about 18 months ago that I thought would work, and I tried it, and, you know, I think it works. So that's why. Just sort of, I've been thinking about this for 35 years, and finally just
found the time is right.
Yeah.
No, it's really interesting. And I guess, because a lot of authors have a lot of ideas, and you obviously do. And I guess just try and put into words, how do you know that that's the thing you should write now? Like you said, you've waited 35 years to write that. How did you actually know it was now, and rather than one of the other many ideas you have in your head?
You know, it's funny. I actually don't have that many ideas. When I get one, I cling to it, you know, with both hands. But no, I do find usually that when an idea seizes me, it really seizes me. I really know. It's like falling in love with somebody, you know, where you just know that, you know, your next however long of your life is going to be consumed by this romance, whatever it may be.
Oh, no, that's
by the way, just a flashback from that. You're right. I do write in different genres, and I think it's a really big mistake. And any of your creative people that are listening in, it's a lot smarter commercially, I think, to find an identity and stay with it. But I somehow can't. The muse kind of leads me in a lot of different directions. And although I'm sure there is a common thread, but it's not obvious.
It's so interesting you say that, because I was actually going to ask you about personal branding, because, you know, most of my audience will know you from The War of Art and Turning Pro, which I quote all the time. I'm always like, go and read Turning Pro. And would you have considered, and maybe earlier, now it's a bit too late now, but using two different names? Like, if people want to write in different genres, do you recommend different brands, different names?
You know, that's another great question. I just was thinking about that yesterday, because I'm working on another novel now that, again, is out of my genre. And I was just thinking that my name will be meaningless as far as selling that book. And I thought to myself, maybe I should just use a pen name and go, you know, make it seem like a debut novel. So I've never done it. I don't know how it works. But I think there might be something to that, because it if you're known and if you're branded in one certain area, and then you suddenly do something. It's like when Bob Dylan went electric, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody practically murdered him for that, you know, because he was, you know, changing their expectations. He was subverting their expectations. People don't like that. They want, it's like, there was Woody Allen always says, people are saying to him, why don't you go back and do the funny movies that you used to do? We love those funny movies. Why are you doing these depressing movies now? So there may be something to doing a pen name.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just thinking forward. I'm really into the AI stuff and machine learning, and Amazon algorithms do a lot with author name. So the brand is not just external, it's kind of in the machines, and they're training around who buys the books. And so I think it's a really good idea from like a technical viewpoint. And a lot of indies now have multiple pen names per subgenre on Amazon.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah, yeah, interesting stuff.
I didn't know that. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
exactly. So I have a question then. I have a question around, so basically a lot of authors, when they first start writing, often seem to write fiction based on their own life story.
Yes.
And there is an inherent problem, which is how do you balance self-indulgent memoir with a story that people actually want to read, like you've done with The Knowledge? Because it's kind of half memoir, half fiction, right? So how did you skirt that balance?
That's another great question, Joanna. And I can tell you that, like, the first three novels that I wrote that were never published, they were unpublishable and unpublished, were autobiographical. And they fell into that exact category of being too lame and too ordinary and too, you know, they just didn't get over the hump into being something that was fit for human consumption. And I remember when I first wrote pure fiction, it was a screenplay. And I vowed that from then on, I would never write anything that had anything to do with me, that would never have any characters that were based on people I knew and had nothing to do with real events. And that had been my guiding principle for like 30 years or so. Mm-hmm. And I only changed it for the Knowledge. And in a way, I think it's a real skill. I don't know how anybody does it, write about their own life and make it work, unless they've had a lot of experience and are really a pro writer. Because I think the real skill, I think, is being able to zoom back and see the character that's you in a completely objective way. And that's really hard, because if you're writing about your own life, you're usually writing about certain pain that you went through, you were a drug addict, you know, you're whatever, you know, and it's live stuff to you, really, in your emotion. And you, if as long as that's the case, I don't think it's possible to write about it. I think a lot of times when we read a memoir, and it seems to us, oh my God, it's like human blood is on the page, you know, viscera is there. Mm. We have to remember, it's a performance. It's really, it's like when you see a great torch singer sing some heartbreaking song and you think, oh man, and she's tearing her guts up on the stage. But in fact, she sung this song 5,000 times, and it's her skill to act the song and make you believe that. But you do definitely have to have that distance to be able to treat the character that's you and the other characters that are people you know as if they were fictional characters. Manipulate them and make them say things they didn't really say, etc.
So, which
I don't know if that's an answer, but that's my answer.
No, it is. It's great. And I mean, there are failed relationships in the book. There are dead end jobs. There are rejected manuscripts. As you say, there's the dark moments. And I wanted to ask you about tapping into the shadow side, so sharing your darker side in your books. How do you recommend that authors kind of tap those deeper places?
It's really, really difficult. Like I wrote a blog post a couple of weeks ago. It was called Two Paragraphs. That was the title. And what it was about The Knowledge. And in that book, there are two paragraphs following each other that are absolutely true from my heart, the real stuff that really took place in my real life that I've been trying to write about. And I couldn't for 35 years. And the whole rest of the book is just there to carry those two paragraphs. So you got to be incredibly careful in using that real stuff, because it goes over into self-pity. You totally lose objectivity on it. And it needs a stroke of genius, I think, in the sense of the concept of the story. What's an example? I don't know. I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but for instance, there's a movie out right now called Midnight Special. Hmm. And have you seen it or heard of it?
No.
It's sort of sci-fi, and it's about a little boy who has some incredible gift. He can like bring satellites down out of the sky. He has this weird power. And the story is about his father. The boy is being pursued by this cult, this apocalyptic cult, and by the NSA, this American spies. And it's a kind of a road picture of his father trying to protect him. And if you look at that story, there may have been a real story. The writer may have been a father whose son died or something like that. So what he did, he knew he couldn't write that story, I'm guessing, because it would be just too heart-wrenching and too close to the truth. So he took it into the realm of sci-fi. Let's say his son was so special to him, as kids always are, right? So he said, let me expand that specialness. I'll give this kid gifts. He shoots lightning bolts out of his eyes. He can bring, you know, satellites down out of the sky. And he is also trying to get to just those two paragraphs that are maybe about a father being able to release his son to death or to whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it needs some brilliant stroke to make it work, but it's very, very fraught with danger using your real dark side in there. Much easier to invent a dark villain and make the whole thing metaphorical and tell it as fiction.
But do you think by doing that, it's kind of cathartic that in writing such a book, you have almost exorcised that side, or is it still there?
That's another great question, Joanna. And it is cathartic. And I wondered if it would be. And it definitely is. I really felt like with the knowledge that I've sort of put something to rest, at least in my own head. I mean, it was a sort of a crime that I committed, as you know from reading it. And you can never make up for that. But at least I've sort of put it on the page in a form that other people can relate to, rather than just some crazy journal that I might write, you know, and bury it in the sand somewhere. So, yeah, it definitely was cathartic. It did work.
Fantastic. Well, I want to switch topics a bit, because the knowledge has a picture of a taxi on the front, which obviously is in the book. But I wanted to ask you about the title. Now, I'm in Britain and lived in London, so I understand the title. But I wonder if you would maybe explain the title for people who might not understand it.
Okay. as you know, Joanna, if you are going to be a licensed London taxi driver, there's a test you have to pass, because like in New York City is laid out, the streets are laid out in a grid, right? There's First Street, Second Street, Third Street, First, Second, Third Avenue. So you can be an idiot like I was and find your way around New York. But London is this maze of 20,000 lanes, alleys, back byways and stuff like that, because it evolved over, 2,000 years, the city, right? So before you can be a taxi driver and get your license, you have to learn all those streets, and there's a test, and that is called the knowledge. And I think if you ride in a London taxi cab today, there's a little sign that says to be viewed by the passenger saying, don't worry, I've got the knowledge. And the test is, it's called calling a run. And the examiner will say to the taxi driver, take us from Earl's Court to, Basil Street. And you have to recite, you, the testee, you know, turn right, turn left, zig, zag, and get there. But of course, in the book, the knowledge refers to, is metaphorical. It refers to the knowledge of life, of learning how life works, both on the external level, what you have to know to navigate, and also internally, your own internal demons and your own self-destructive stuff, and even previous lives and obsessions and things like that. So that was the meaning of the knowledge.
And well, the reason I ask is because when I write, I often come up with a title first because I love, you know, I come up with something and then I'm like, oh, that's cool. I'm going to write about that, you know, in fiction, like fun things. When did you come up with the title and how do you normally come up with titles for books? Do they come later? And what do you recommend for authors who struggle with titles? Because it's a big deal, right? A book title.
It is a big deal. And I think you're very smart, Joanna, to do it first. Anytime I luck onto a title first, which is rare, 1 out of 5, I consider that great. Mm. Big help. Usually it's afterwards. But I think the key thing about a title is it has to be on theme. It has to be sort of what the book is about, like the title Chinatown for the Jack Nicholson movie is exactly about, you know, that the surface of things is not what's really beneath the surface. Mm. And so in groping for titles, I always try to find something. I ask myself, what's the theme of this thing? What is it about? You know, The Sun Also Rises is a great title like that. To Kill a Mockingbird is a great title like that. So I thought the knowledge worked for this.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because you've talked about in many of your blog posts and your books about how often you don't know what the book's about until Sean reads it. So Sean, for people listening, Sean Coyne being your editor, friend, business partner, everyone also, he's been on the show, fantastic book, The Story Grid. So how did you know the theme of the knowledge first? Like how did you find out the theme and how do you in a book? How do we do it? Because we don't have Sean.
First of all, I think it's really hard. I don't know why, but the theme wants to hide and keep away from us. And I think as I've gotten, I would say for the first 20, 25 years that I wrote, I didn't even know what a theme was. It didn't even cross my mind. I wrote completely on instinct. And it wasn't maybe 2 or 3 years later, somebody would say to me, oh, that book is about such and such. And I kind of scratch my head and go, oh, yeah, I guess it is. You know? So I think a lot of great books have been written and movies have been made where the writer had no clue what the theme was. But as I get older or more experienced, I try to do that exercise earlier. And to try to find out, and you just have to ask yourself the question kind of over and over, what is this about? You know, like Casablanca is about, the theme is, it's better to act for the greater good of the community, of the nation, than your own selfish, motives. Mm. The theme of the first movie, Rocky, is any bum can be a champ if he's only given the chance, which is a sort of expression of the American dream in a way, you know? Yeah. And the Australian dream too. But I find that I have a theme when I have a file when I start a book, and it's called theme. And I kind of go back to it again and again, and I'm sort of right, literally, I go, what is this damn thing about? And I'll sort of write out a few paragraphs and I'll go back to those paragraphs again. And I'll go, no, that's not it. That's not really. And I'll try again and again and again. And finally, once you know it, I know you know this, Joanna, but maybe your viewers haven't heard this. This is a great quote that Robert McKee, the story structure guru, he was interviewing Paddy Chayefsky, the famous three-time Academy Award-winning screenwriter. And they were talking about theme. And this was back in the days before computers. Mm. And Paddy Chayefsky said, as soon as I figure out he was a dramatist more than, he said, as soon as I figure out the theme of my play, I type it out on a single strip of paper, and I scotch tape it to the front of my typewriter. And after that, nothing goes into that play that is not on theme. And that's a real mantra to me. I believe that. But what's interesting about what he said is, as soon as I figure it out, which shows me that he doesn't have it figured out for quite a way. So that's how important. If you get me started on theme, I'll talk for hours.
No, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's really great. And then coming back to the book, I wanted to ask you about Teaspoon the cat, because I really enjoyed the book, but I kept coming back to Teaspoon. I love cats. So I'm a cat person. And it made me think about, and in fact, I think, you know, the cat became the sympathetic character almost, you know, you care about the cat. And I wondered how you think about pets and emotion. Like, was that something from your real life, or was that an emotional hook into readers, like an extra emotional hook with an animal?
Ah, that's another great question, Joanna. I'll give you kind of a lengthy answer to it. I did have a real cat. In my real life, in this time, his name was Mo, M-O, which I decided was not a good fictional name. I'd have a better name. And in the book and in real life, he used to curl up next to my typewriter, and the carriage would just shuttle back and forth over his head, you know, and he would just stay there, you know. So I wrote that in the book, in the knowledge, and I was like halfway through. And then this comes back to the theme. One of the principles of storytelling is that every character in the book must represent an aspect of the theme. So at some point I sort of pulled back and I said, well, what is cat? What does Teaspoon represent? And even though this was real life, I'm asked in the fictional, and I thought, well, he's right next to the typewriter. And he represents kind of the character who was me, his muse. Because while he's there by the typewriter, curled up, my character is doing great. And so, as you know, in the book, Teaspoon gets kidnapped.
Yeah, that was terrible.
So the character that's me goes on this hunt to bring him back. And that's really sort of the metaphor of that, is that the writer, me, has lost his muse, lost his gift, and got to get it back. And so that's sort of a way that real life becomes treated as fiction and enlisted in the cause of fiction. And now I would imagine that, say, in The Sun Also Rises, let's say Hemingway, the real Hemingway, had an affair with a real woman that was the equivalent of Lady Brett Ashley. And at some point when he was structuring The Sun Also Rises, I'm sure he asked himself, what does she represent? What is his character, Jake Barnes, love for her mean, et cetera, et cetera. And after that, I'm sure he changed certain events and made them work like fiction works.
Wow. And it's so funny you saying that about Teaspoon. And of course, I didn't think that at all. I just thought the cat got kidnapped, but you've added that depth, that layer. And just kind of winding back, you know, back to those days.
Let me get back a second, Joanna, so I don't take so much credit here. Let's go back to Sean. When Sean read this book for the first time, in the first pass, Teaspoon did not get kidnapped. Mm-hmm. So Sean said to me, you got to have the cat kidnapped, you know? And so I went back, you know, I said, he's right. That really, and what the analogy he used was the movie The Big Lebowski, if you remember that, with Jeff Bridges, where they steal his carpet. And the whole movie, he's trying to get his carpet back, you know. And as dumb as that sounds, it works, right? You and the audience are going, is he going to get his carpet? Is he going to get his carpet? So that was Sean's idea, to have Teaspoon kidnapped. But it worked exactly according to the metaphor I was just talking about.
That's fantastic. And I guess my question is about how do you learn this stuff over time? Like, you're a very experienced writer. You've been doing this for years. Do you find that you're still learning stuff? And like, what has surprised you, I guess, in the last year that you've gone, oh, I'm going to add that to my repertoire?
That's another great question. But I can tell you this, that blogging about this and having writing books like The War of Art and Turning Pro and so on, really, they always say you learn when you teach. Mm-hmm. And it's really true that a lot of ideas that you sort of know passively You know, if somebody were to ask you, you'd be able to answer. When you teach it, when you write it, you make that active. It's not passive, it's active. Now it's in the front of your brain. I can't think of, I know there has been something, you know, that recently has really kicked in, but I'm blanking on it right now, Joanna. But you're right, it constantly happens. And as a professional, you sort of feel like you're adding it to your repertoire. I'm sure singers do this and actors do this. They learn as they go along. Mm. For me, just to digress a little bit, I worked for about 10 years as a screenwriter in Hollywood, as you know. Mm. And that was the greatest learning experience. A lot of what I know or what I think I know, I learned there, because just in the process of working with people, and you know, you would go into a meeting about a script that you'd written, and the studio exec would say something like, "Well, what's the all is lost moment here?" And you go, "What? The what?" You know, and then you know, then you learn, and all these little one little element at a time.
Mm.
But the smartest thing for anybody that wants to know that is read my books about writing. I put everything I know in there.
Yeah. And but of course, as you keep learning, that's why we're all waiting for more books, you know. So
yeah, right. but there will be more because I keep learning.
Exactly. Well, I want to just, coming back on screenwriting. So I tried to adapt one of my own books for a screenplay, and I just failed miserably, and it just seemed so hard. Screenwriting seems like another skill that's totally different to writing fiction.
It is.
So do you recommend like people who write novels should have like learn a lot of the principles of screenwriting, or even try screenwriting to get better at telling story?
I certainly think it's very helpful, because in screenwriting or writing for the movies, there are a lot more restrictions than on a novel. So it helps to learn. Like, for instance, you really can't go inside a character's head in the movies, right? So everything has to be shown in action or in dialogue. And you can't go on any long descriptions of things like you do in novels. And you can't rely on your gift for prose, where you can kind of just do some wonderful prose. So I don't know. I don't know how to dabble in screenwriting, but the only way I think is like move to LA and go through hell for a few years. But I do think they are two separate skills. Mm. In fact, you know, a few of my books recently have been, you know, optioned for movies, and I'll be in a meeting and someone will say, well, would you like to write the screenplay? And I immediately say no. Mm. And the reason is, I'm not a good enough screenwriter. I was like maybe a B-list or a C-list screenwriter, not an A-list screenwriter. And I would, if a book of mine was going to be adapted, I would want to get somebody that was really good to do it.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. Okay, I want to ask you about the picture on the back of the book, which is awesome. It's a very cool looking Steve Nextra sign saying dangerous. And the ad is amazing, and I've shared it on Twitter and everywhere because it's a great hook.
Thanks.
No, it's just brilliant. So how did you decide on that hook for the advertising? Because it's kind of stunning picture. Did you take that picture all those years ago? No. Knowing that you'd do this one day.
But I thought it was a funny picture. Mm. And certainly people that know me and my grizzled old self here might be amused to see me, you know, when I had hair, you know. But
you worked in advertising, so you know about the hooks, right? So why did you decide that picture was the hook for the ad?
It's a good question, but I did think of it that way. I mean, if you call it the ad says Steve's all is lost moment, 1974. Mm. And I don't know if that works or not.
No, it does.
But I felt like that the audience would be people who who subscribe to my blog. That was the, because nobody else was going to see it, whatever it was. And that they sort of knew who I was in a vague sense because they maybe had read The War of Art or something. And that this picture and that headline would sort of make the promise it would make would be, see another side of this person that you think you know. Mm. So again, I don't know if it worked or not, but that was the concept behind it.
Mm.
I loved the photo. I thought it was really a great photo. And I just thought there's got to be some way to use it. So, but we did sit down, me and Jeff Simon, who's our kind of design, tech, brilliant, creative dude, and try to come up with something, just like ad people did.
Yeah, I think it's super effective. And I just wanted to mention your book, Nobody Wants to Read Your Shit, which which is basically about marketing. And you mentioned your blog a number of times, and a lot of authors these days seem to think that blogging might be a waste of time. How do you feel your blog fits into your personal marketing, book marketing, as well as expression?
Another great question, Joanne. I mean, it's sort of conventional wisdom these days that if you're a writer, when I say these days, I mean these days when there are no more book reviews in basically in newspapers, and a writer, the real problem is how do you gain awareness out in the real world that your book even exists? Forget about whether it's good or bad. And so the conventional wisdom is you need to sort of have a tribe, you know, have people that are aware of you. And the way to make that happen is to have like a blog or something like that where you're giving, you know, wisdom or information or inside stuff over time. And theoretically, you acquire an audience that follows you. And then when a book comes out, at least you can announce it to them, even if nobody else is going to know that. And it's, I mean, I wish it was back to the old days, like Hemingway and stuff, where a writer could just be a writer, you know, and could be reclusive, like Philip Roth. I mean, he would never have a blog or anything like that. He would never stoop so low as to do that. But it is kind of fun. I mean, I've been doing it for like 6 years or something like that. Mm. And like I say, you learn when you teach. And every time I read a post about some aspect of writing or of the professional mindset or of overcoming self-sabotage, I learn. Mm. So I wish I was doing it better. I wish I had a bigger audience than I do. But it does seem to be something that helps, you know? Mm. I know a lot of people turn their noses up at it. And I did too for a while, but I think it's a good thing but it's very time consuming, as you know. You know, it can be a full-time job just about.
Yeah, exactly. But every time I think, I just, you know, I shouldn't do this anymore, I should just write, I look at you and I go, no, because there's clearly benefit. And okay, so last question. You and Sean Coyne obviously publish many of your books under Black Irish, which is your imprint. How do you see the publishing industry right now?
Wow, I wish Sean was here to answer that, because he knows a lot more about it than I do. But it's like a book I wrote like 2 books ago called The Lion's Gate, which was a big, serious nonfiction treatment of the Six-Day War, the Arab-Israeli War of 1967, was brought out in the mainstream press. Penguin Books did it. And to my amazement, basically their promotion pitch was to say to me, why don't you promote it? So, in other words, if you're sort of self-published or you have a small indie press, you're up against that problem that you don't have very much reach. But I think even among the big five publishers, they don't have that much reach either, because it's like in the old days, they had relationships and they could get the New York Times or the London Times or whatever to review a book. But nowadays, so few books get reviewed there. Like for somebody like me that's been around for a while, I will never have a book reviewed by the New York Times ever again. So it's really hard. I think it's probably the book biz for the writer's point of view is harder than it's ever been. And the ones who seem to succeed, other than the big brand name people that are out there, are people who build a cult or a tribe themselves. And I keep hearing these stories about, like, these female writers who write this kind of bodice-ripping stuff, you know?
Romance.
And romance, whatever it is. And they have, like, they write saga after saga, and they've got, like, hundreds of thousands of followers that scoop these things up right away. So that would be really – I'd love to read an article about that if someone would research those kind of people. But otherwise, publishing, it's very, very tough these days, even with a big five mainstream publisher. They have limited clout, even at that level. Mm. Unless you're writing a book about Donald Trump or a cookbook or a book about cats. In that case, all bets are off and it's a bestseller. But if you're trying to write real fiction, it's tough.
Mm. No, fantastic.
And if you're like me and you switch genres, it's even tougher. Don't switch genres.
Well, you have a fan base in my audience who are all writers and all love your books. So whatever you come out with, you know, we'll be there.
Thank you, Joanna. Thank you.
So tell people what...
I'm a huge fan of you, too.
Oh, that's lovely. So where can people find you and your books online?
My website is just my name, Stephen Pressfield. And, of course, we have Sean and my little company, Black Irish Books. www.blackirishbooks, and that's where they are. And of course, they're on Amazon and all of those places.
I got to ask you as well, do you do your own Twitter account at S Pressfield?
No.
Is that Callie? No.
Yeah, Callie does it. I got to learn. I mean, if Donald Trump can do it, I can do it, you know? I got to figure out how to do it. Although you got to end with the word sad, exclamation point.
Oh, well, thanks so much for your time, Steve. That was great.
Hey, thank you, Joanna. As always, as you know, I've never give interviews except to you and like two other people. So it's just so much fun because you're so great at it. So thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Steve, and definitely check out his new book, The Knowledge, or get your butt kicked by reading Turning Pro, because that book has something new every time I open it. I'll be back next week with an interview with entrepreneur Tara Gentile about how to balance art and business. We talk about how to make that first $100 a month for those just starting out, and also how to get from six figures to seven figures. And her thoughts on this helped me redesign my business plan when we met in October last year. So I'm thrilled to have Tara on the show next week. So happy writing, and I'll see you next Monday. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes, available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.